The word ghetto began its journey in 1516 Venice, when authorities confined Jews to an island called Ghetto Nuovo. 5 centuries later, this concept continues to shape our understanding of racial inequality in America. What started as religious segregation in medieval Europe evolved through Nazi Germany's deadly implementation and finally to American cities, where it became the physical manifestation of our unresolved struggle with race and power. The ghetto represents a paradox, a space of both control and community, oppression and resilience. Through this lens, we can understand how segregated spaces simultaneously restrict opportunity while nurturing distinct cultural identities. This isn't just history, it's the living backdrop against which American cities continue to evolve, segregate, and occasionally transform. When Venetian authorities established the ghetto, they created a compromise that legitimized Jewish presence while controlling it. Gates operated from sunrise to sunset with Christian guards monitoring movement. Despite restrictions, Jewish communities developed autonomy and cultural richness within these confined spaces. The concept spread across Europe. In Rome, Pope Paul IV's 1555 decree forced Jews into a flood-prone area along the Tiber River, though Jews continued working outside while maintaining their Roman Jewish identity. Napoleon's troops eventually demolished many ghetto gates, declaring Via della Libertà. By the early 20th century, ghetto described high-density Jewish neighborhoods in Warsaw and New York's Lower East Side, places of voluntary concentration rather than legal mandate. The Nazis later claimed to revive church traditions, but Hitler's ghettos represented unprecedented cruelty, with barbed wire and death for escape attempts. Unlike historical ghettos allowing conversion as escape, Nazi segregation offered no way out. When the term later described Black American neighborhoods, it was this Nazi reference point, not the Renaissance version, that provided the mental image, despite profound differences between Warsaw and Harlem. When Horace Caton addressed an AME church about housing violence in 1944 Chicago, he spoke from experience. The grandson of the first Black U.S. senator had known both privilege and imprisonment for violating segregation laws. Caton exposed how race-restrictive covenants confined hundreds of thousands of Black Chicagoans to small sections of the South Side. Though appearing grassroots, these agreements among white property owners were enforced by powerful national organizations, creating invisible but effective barriers. Nearby, the University of Chicago's sociology department pioneered urban ethnography while actively supporting the very restrictive covenants their researchers documented. Not natural development, but engineered separation. Kenneth Clark later transformed our understanding of Northern segregation. Raised in Harlem, Clark began his activism at Howard University in 1934, protesting Capitol restaurant segregation decades before the 1960s movement. Clark's research showing Black children preferring white dolls became crucial evidence in Brown v. Board of Education. As a New Yorker, Clark recognized Northern urban problems require different solutions than Southern civil rights issues. Housing segregation and police abuse versus desegregating lunch counters. Clark's 1965 book Dark Ghetto broke 20 years of silence on U.S. ghettos in social science literature. Rejecting objective approaches, he compared himself to Holocaust scholars who refused emotional detachment. His ghetto represented the institutionalization of powerlessness where victims internalized their supposed inferiority. In 1978, William Julius Wilson controversially argued in The Declining Significance of Race that economic factors had surpassed race in determining Black life chances. He claimed educated Blacks accessed new opportunities, while those lacking education faced limited prospects regardless of race. Kenneth Clark countered that race remained dominant, arguing middle-class Blacks still faced tokenism and depended on white goodwill through special programs. Wilson's term underclass for poorly educated ghetto residents went largely unchallenged, giving scientific legitimacy to a label previously used by Time magazine for unreachable and antagonistic poor blacks. By the late 1970s, black communities had transformed significantly. Many middle-class blacks relocated to mixed-race neighborhoods and suburbs, leaving behind isolated poor communities. Cities like Washington, D.C., Detroit, and Atlanta developed substantial middle-class black populations, and many cities elected their first black mayors following the Voting Rights Act. Wilson later introduced concentration effects to explain how middle-class flight left poor blacks without social buffers, creating isolated communities with severely restricted opportunities compared to poor whites who rarely experienced such concentrated poverty. While academics debated whether ghettos resulted from unemployment, welfare dependency, or segregation, Jeffrey Canada viewed them as transformable through integrated children's services. Growing up in the violent South Bronx, Canada learned that status came from fearlessness. After attending Bowdoin and Harvard, his work with troubled youth showed how a few program busters could undermine any environment. Backed by billionaire Stanley Druckenmiller, Canada expanded the Reedland Center into the Harlem Children's Zone, 24 blocks of comprehensive services from infancy through adolescence, including Baby College for parents and the Promise Academy Charter School. Reality proved harsh. Incoming sixth graders tested 2-3 years below grade level, with some performing worse after a year. Wealthy board members wanted to remove bad apples and implement stricter models, viewing students like stock picks and wanting to protect the brand by selecting only motivated children. When the experiment initially failed, Canada took responsibility rather than blaming the children. He shifted to reaching children much earlier, aligning with research suggesting intervention after age 6 or 7 comes too late. The black ghetto has evolved from a semi-flourishing segregated community to one under heightened external control. In early ghettos, black men worked servile jobs but returned to communities with minimal police presence. Since the 1960s, the war on drugs has intensified policing and incarceration. Nearly 20% of black men in their 30s have served prison time, reaching 60% among high school dropouts. America largely failed to address ghetto conditions despite scholarly attention and anti-poverty programs. When 1990s budget surpluses could have funded meaningful interventions, the nation prioritized wars instead. Meanwhile, gentrification has brought young professionals who invest in real estate while isolating their children in private or charter schools. The ghetto concept remains essential for understanding poor black communities characterized by restricted space based on race and wealth, mechanisms perpetuating prejudice, rationalized spatial inequality, control by outside institutions, exploitation by landlords, economic exclusion, complex internal social dynamics, and fundamentally, an intergenerational phenomenon persisting across time. The ghetto reveals how spatial arrangements express and reinforce social hierarchies. Unlike slum, which merely describes physical conditions, ghetto captures power relationships between dominant and subordinate groups. Many scholars who shaped our understanding experience this tension between academic study and lived reality. As cities transform through gentrification and economic shifts, the ghetto demonstrates how racial inequality persists despite legal equality. The spaces we inhabit shape our opportunities, identities, and futures. Geography isn't neutral, it's political, historical, and personal. Can we create cities where zip codes don't determine destiny? The ghetto's 5-century history shows that spatial justice is fundamental to social justice. Until we confront how power manifests in place, we cannot truly address America's unfinished work of creating equal opportunity for all.